Carol Avery. But 5 years ago, I did quite a series of talks in the Middle East. At the time, my husband and I were living in Saudi Arabia. We lived there for 5 years, from 1983 to 1988. And though I'm by no means an expert on the Middle East or Islam or anything else, I feel like I have a pretty good everyday feel for it. And I started a little too soon, I guess. This is a session on the Middle East.
Okay. Yeah.
Well, let's see. I guess I'll
just let's get some more chairs.
We'll get a little bit more back there, too.
Moved you back you up a little bit?
Well, that's fine. I just didn't want to be up here.
I think it'll be good if we can leave some over there. So
the lake
can
sneak over.
Right.
I don't know.
Yes.
Thank you much. Okay, let's start again. For those of you who just walked in, my name is Carol Avery, and my husband and I lived in Saudi Arabia from 1983 to 1988. It was a place we didn't really overtly choose to live in. In fact, a few years before, when we were feeling adventuresome and wanted to travel the world, John came home with an ad in the paper looking for English teachers in Saudi Arabia, and I said, that is the last place I will ever go in my whole life. I hate the heat, I hate the sand, I certainly don't like what I hear about what it's like to be a woman in that country. Sure enough, the first job that came along after graduate school, and we were so poor we didn't know where the next penny was coming from, was in Saudi Arabia, and we went, and we had the one daughter at the time. She was three and a half, and so that was really her home, and she'd move back in a second if she had the chance. She really loved living there, and loves going to the ocean, loves going to the beach, and so on.
How long did you stay there?
For 5 years.
Right. Uh-huh.
So today I'm going to try to talk about, start out talking about women in the Middle East, and then we'll kind of open it up for whatever questions you may have, or whatever you want to talk about. I'm real open towards that. Women in the Middle East is a pretty broad topic, and really the best knowledge I have is of women in Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is probably the strictest of all the Muslim countries, and so what I lived with was the most severe living conditions for a woman of any of the Middle Eastern countries. And friends of mine from other countries such as Egypt, Lebanon, Turkey, which isn't Middle East, but other Muslim countries, they actually found it even harder than the Westerners to live in Saudi Arabia, because they felt like the expectations on them were a lot greater than on us. And they, several friends, absolutely hated living there because they had never worn a veil, they'd never been covered. Some of the Egyptian women had, but certainly not in Turkey. And they had a very hard time accepting the fact that suddenly they were supposed to be proper like the others. As a woman born in Saudi Arabia, probably a young girl is born into a very large household because her mother lives with the father's extended family. The houses are enormous, and not only because it's an extended family, but because it's almost two houses together, the women's side and the men's side. And they are kept very separate for the most part, a little bit of intermingling within the family. So young girls and boys are raised together, mainly with their mother, but with aunts and uncles and grandparents and such. And they play together and pretty much not even go to school. They, from the very start, are separate in school. But playgrounds, you would see the boys and girls playing together until puberty, really, age 13 or even 12. I taught in an American school, sixth grade over there. And though it was an American school, there were more Pakistanis than Americans, and just in my one class of 25, I had 18 different nationalities, so very many. But even by sixth grade, the kids were already really feeling, the Muslim children were feeling now that they had to start playing the rules. And the real example was during Ramadan, which is the whole month of fasting. The boys, especially in my sixth grade class, would start out determined that they were going to fast for the whole month, which wasn't very realistic. In an American school, we did nothing to cater to the Ramadan. And the kids were outside for PE, and they were out in the hot, hot weather. And to fast means not to eat or drink anything during the sun, the daylight hours. And but many of these boys in sixth grade were determined they were going to do it. Not very many of them made it through the whole month, but they started out that way. So anyway, by the time they turned 12 or 13, that's when the girls now are kept almost completely separate from the boys. The girls are veiled and wear an abaya out in public. And usually it's something they really look forward to. I think much as our children look forward to doing the adult sort of things, wearing makeup or whatever, the little girls really count the days till they can wear the abaya. And we would often see out in the playground these what looked to me like little girls, long black robes, trying to traverse the monkey bars and the jungle gyms. And proud of it. I mean, that's sort of their adulthood, right? The woman, of course, is pretty much confined to her home. And as a Westerner in that country, we found it virtually impossible to get to know any Saudis because of that, because they remain so guarded. So when they are out in public, you can't see their faces. You can't even make eye contact. There were very few Westerners who got to know a Saudi family as intimate friends. And the ones who did worked at it all the time. They had to really be aggressive, really try to get into the culture in a big way. And the Saudis want it that way. They prefer it that way. They'd never offered Arabic courses to us. They never encouraged us to be out where the Saudi people were. And thus, I mean, I'm very embarrassed to say it, but in 5 years I learned just only a smattering of Arabic for that reason. When I went shopping in the stores, the shopkeepers, the clerks, were always Pakistanis, Indians, Thais, all spoke English. None of them spoke Arabic either. And so so it was very almost impossible to learn. But anyway, so back to the women, they are very much, as we have come to see them from this country, as being veiled, being covered, being kept at home. The men commonly are the ones to do the grocery shopping. That's who you'd often see in the stores. And for good reason, when you live in a country that can be up to 120 degrees and you are required to be clothed in black from head to foot, it just isn't something that's very desirable, I think, for anybody. But there are women's schools, there are women's colleges, completely separate from men's, and only taught by women, with the exception if there is a male teacher, it usually teaches over closed-circuit TV so that there's no eye contact at all. And so there are women who choose professions, mainly being teaching and nursing, and a very, very few that get into engineering and technical fields. Aramco, which is the huge oil company there, often likes to make a big production of the fact that they do have women working in their on their board of directors, I don't think on the board of directors, but in their administration. But there are, in fact, only probably one or two, and I'm sure that they are very limited in what they can do. So the opportunities for the women is, of course, very, very limited, and I think many of them sort of prefer it that way and choose that way, and others are very, very frustrated by it and really resent the fact that there's nothing they can do other than staying at home. I always tried to remind myself in that culture that it really wasn't very many years ago that it was the very same way, virtually, in our Western countries. I mean, what's it been since the 20s that women could even vote? Wasn't long, wasn't even 100 years ago that women dressed, I think, much in the same way, always wearing the long skirts and the long sleeves. And so I think oftentimes we look at it and we think, oh, it is so repressive, and how could anybody live this way? And really, it isn't that far in our past that we lived in much, much the same way, women being at home, pretty much having no opportunities at all. As a Western woman living in the country, it was a real experience. It's probably the best word. I went to Saudi Arabia feeling very open, very culturally sensitive. I really thought, you know, it's their culture. If they do it, it's all right. And by the fifth year, I was feeling pretty bitter about a lot of things. The fact that women can't drive at all in that country was got to be a real burden. In fact, if we ever wanted to go to the store, it had to be the whole family and John driving us there. With the exception that we did live on the university campus. John, by the way, taught English at the University of Petroleum and Minerals in Dahran, which for now everybody is very aware of and probably knows in detail since the Gulf War. That was pretty much the center point. And we did have a recreation center and a small store on campus. And women were allowed, not legally, but allowed to drive just to the store and to the recreation center on campus. We had to be very careful. Our insurance man always said, don't do it. He said, if you were ever in an accident, you know, you wouldn't be covered a penny. But I like most of the other Western women, did drive that just that little ways. The recreation center, of course, had two swimming pools, the men's swimming pool and the women's swimming pool. And so we all swam. Usually I was with the children on the one side, John on the other. But they did on one morning a week, on Thursday morning, which is the equivalent of our Saturday morning, they did have family swim, though it could never be publicized, it could never be talked about, but they did allow for 3 hours on Thursday morning for everybody to swim in the men's pool. But there were so many things like that where the rule said one thing, but what you did was another thing. And so for a while it was sort of, you know, you weren't quite sure what the real rule was, because if ever you asked if you could swim together, the answer would always be no. I got a teaching job teaching sixth grade at the American school, and the school was on the consulate grounds. And so it was an entirely different world being at school. I could dress in a regular dress. It was just like an American school here. To go into town, on the other hand, was quite a different story, in that I had to be really very careful about wearing always long sleeves and a long skirt. And that was the most interesting thing to reacclimatize to in coming back to this country, is it took me months before I could walk into a grocery store in shorts and not feel very self-conscious about it and sort of uncomfortable about it, because it was always a matter of changing clothes before going shopping. That was probably the biggest restriction. Others were just the fact that definitely feeling like you were always treated as a second-class citizen. Never really, you know, anything that was of importance was always dealt with through my husband and not through me. One of the most interesting stories I like to tell that sort of depicts what about women and about living in general in that country is that the year before we went to Saudi Arabia, we lived in Portland, Oregon, where John got his master's degree at Portland State. And he taught English as part of his program. And one of his students was a Saudi woman named Munira. And so when we suddenly had this job opportunity and got offered the job, then it turned out that Munira and her husband Mohammed were from Dahran, and he was studying at Portland State for 4 years. This was their fourth year. And they were very excited when they found out we had gotten this job. We were going to their hometown of Dahran, where they were going to go back in the fall. They had a four-year-old daughter, and our daughter at the time was three, and so she was so excited about that and invited us over to their house, first Jenny and myself, and just a wonderful woman, spoke very good English, and we got together several times. The last time we had them to our house, the whole family, and we sat around the living room and had tea and cookies or whatever, and the girls played in the back, and they kept saying, well, when you come to Dahran, we must get together, and give us a call and so on and so forth. So the time came, we went over in August and they weren't going to arrive till November. And we realized all of a sudden that the time had passed, we'd never heard from them at all. But we had a phone number. So John called one day and said, you know, here we are. And it was, the response was quite cold and quite, just very sort of held back. It was never an invitation to get together or anything. And so I remember him hanging up the phone and sort of shrugging his shoulders saying, well, now what? I don't know what to do. And we never heard from them again. Well, several months later, we talked to friends of ours who really had worked hard to get to know some Saudi people and get in the culture. And they said it was perfectly all right for us to call and sort of invite ourselves over, say, we're coming to town, could we stop by? So though we felt very odd about it, we finally thought, well, we can't pass up this opportunity, and did that. We called and said, well, we're coming through, could we stop by? And that was fine. And so we went and found their house, and as most Saudi homes, it is all walled off, and you go in the gate, and then there's a courtyard. Came to the door, and Mohammeda answered the door, and I felt quite nervous, and all day I was debating whether or not to wear my abaya, which I had. I decided I had to wear it, but the last minute I just couldn't put it on. I just couldn't do it. But I had a long dress on, and I think a scarf in my head. And came to the door, and Mohammed let us in, and right away he sort of pointed towards the room, which I knew was the men's sitting room, and I wasn't sure what to do with myself. I didn't know where else to go, so I sort of blindly followed along, knowing I probably shouldn't be in there, but he didn't tell me where else to go. So it was a very beautiful, plush room, carpeted, huge color television set at the one end, and white velvet couches all around the whole rim. And there we sat. I felt most ill at ease. And they talked for a while. And at one point, I remember Mohammed even turned to John and said, how does your wife like living here? And I sort of said, that's okay. And so they talked about how I liked living there. And I was just feeling more and more uncomfortable. And finally, Mohammed got up and he just left the room. And he came back and he looked at me and he said, do you want to visit with my wife? And I just about jumped up. I was, yes, you know, definitely show me where to go. So then he took me to the other half of the house, and there was Munira and their little daughter, and they seemed very happy to see us. And Jenny and I went with them, and now went into the women's sitting room, which was completely barren, and only had cushions, just kind of tattered cushions, just leaned up against the wall, nothing to sit on. It was barren with these cushions around the edge. I think there was an old black and white TV in the corner, but didn't look like it was very functional. Anyway, we had a very nice visit, and she really seemed happy to see us, and she asked a million questions about Mr. John this and that, because of course he had been her teacher in the first contact, not myself. And we visited, of course, John is still in the other half of the house with Mohammed. There's no way to communicate, dinner invitation was never extended to us, so as far as we were concerned, we were just making a stop by, you know, to visit and say hi. Finally, after an hour or so, the message came in that Mr. John said it was time to go. And Munira got real upset, saying, why do you have to go? I said, well, I don't know, you know, that's what the message says, and I have to leave now. And she was all in a tizzy, went to the kitchen, and here she came back with plates of food with aluminum foil over them for us to take home, because they had planned that dinner. Nobody had ever mentioned it, and she felt real upset that we weren't going to be staying for dinner. But again, you realize how without even an eye contact with somebody to sort of give a clue of what to do. So as we were leaving, she walked out with me and she put on her abaya and she put on her veil, and I thought, well, now finally she's going to come out and talk to John and say something. But she never did. She stood around the corner from where John was and she just said, say hello to Mr. John, and never came out again. And for somebody we had sat together and visited with in Portland, and just had a very friendly relationship, it was obvious that now we were on their turf, the rules were completely different. In talking to Munir, I thought, oh, how repressed she must feel living in Portland for 4 years, speaking English. I don't know if she drove, but she certainly got around in the bus all the time, did her own shopping. I asked her, she said she was never so happy as to be back in her home, back in her traditional role as a woman, covered. I think there is definitely a feeling of protection, which is the whole idea. Also for seeming to be a very modern sort of woman, she was telling me the story of meeting Mohammed, or her husband, finding Mohammed for her. And in this day and age, it's the father is often instrumental, but it isn't like it used to be where he always found the husband. And often what happens now is the father will find a suitable mate for his daughter, but then will give them a chance to meet and get to know each other, and the daughter has a chance to say, no, I'm not, no way, I'm not interested. But Munira said, when her father found Mohammed, that she didn't want to meet him until the day they were married, because that was the right thing to do. And so she never saw him until the day that they were married. So as much as you think that women must feel very repressed, and I think many do, and many really rebel against the system, for the majority, when it's what you're used to, when it's what you're raised in, what your whole culture tells you, then it's what you're comfortable with. To me, seeing a woman who I consider to be quite westernized and lived in a very western society, and yet that's what she wanted, that's what she was comfortable with, says a lot. And so I'm always hesitant when I talk to women who have this sort of idea of we have to get in there and liberate them and give them their rights. The whole idea, the reason that the culture came about that way is that Mohammed came about in a time in the late 6th century when women were absolutely mistreated and abused and treated, discarded and treated just very much as property and as things. And the Quran was written in a way to help women and to protect them. And in that context, women in that culture have many rights that they never did before. They have the right to own their own property, to keep their own property. True, a husband can divorce a woman by saying, I divorce you, I divorce you, I divorce you, 3 times. The women also can instigate a divorce proceedings if they're being abused, if their husband isn't taking care of them. The husband does have the right to have up to 4 wives, but it's very rare anymore that it happens, because the ruling is that you shall have 4 wives if you can treat them equally and if you can provide for them equally. And in this day and age, that's very hard to do. So I never knew of any Saudi man who had more than 1 wife. I think it's just becoming less and less acceptable, even though it's in their scripture is allowed.
How is the divorce rate there? Or do they divorce, or is that...
They do. I don't think it's very high. Uh-huh. As many things in that culture, it's hard to find facts. It's hard to find statistics, because so much of it happens sort of in the secret. Oh. But yes, it does happen. The husband has many rights over the children, being the father. Mm-hmm. And I think, as happens fairly frequently, Western women end up marrying Saudi men and Arab men when they come to this country for education. They don't quite so much anymore, but they used to pretty much all come to the United States or England for their education, and often meet a woman, fall in love. I've met several women who had been engaged to a Saudi man, a couple women I did, who then broke off the engagement, and they talked about how alluring it was. Here was this very tall, handsome man with loads of money. You know, money was no object, and driving the sportiest car, so it's easy to get wrapped up in that relationship. But as everyone says, the same thing that I found out, when you're in their country now, the rules are completely changed. And
My granddaughter married Saudi Arabian.
Uh-huh.
And She met him in college and they were married. And he, of course, had lots of money until his father found out he had married a Christian girl. He cut off the money completely.
Did the marriage last?
No, the marriage has not lasted.
Mm-hmm.
But the son, he happens to be the youngest son, is staying in America. And he works for the Republican Party in Minnesota.
Is that right? Mm-hmm. Interesting. There's a wonderful book called At the Drop of a Veil, and the lady who wrote it, her name escapes me right now. It's a bit dated because I think it was written in the 50s, but it was this exact story of a woman who met and married a Saudi in America, went back to that country, was suddenly deposited with his mother and family, and he took off. And over the years, her life just got most unbearable, and so she did finally divorce him, but it was a very, very hard procedure.
They wanted Callie to go back.
Uh-huh.
They wanted them both to come. But
if the children reach the age of 7, then the father has all rights over the children. And so it's very hard in that way for women to get away with their children in hand.
Of course, my daughter never let her go.
Mm-hmm.
She was afraid that...
Right. I know in this case, the mother actually had to escape with the children and go into hiding for quite a while.
Before she could get them to America
and actually legally get possession. Did you have any questions?
We met a week ago Saturday. That was at Silverwood when we were there. A very warm day, warmer than today.
Mm-hmm.
And she had a small baby in this. She had the black dress and the veil and the whole bit. And the baby looked probably like it was about a month or two. The dad was out going with the boy, who was probably about 7, going the rides. They were eating. He find him, and she had a follow, you know, way behind him with this baby. And you could tell she was just drenched underneath, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And my husband felt so sorry for her. And he finally came back and brought her a bag of popcorn. But he and the other boy and another little girl, they were just going around doing all the things and enjoying themselves. And this poor thing was just following along behind with the baby.
It's hard to enjoy when you're covered from head to toe. I do have, did bring my abaya and veil just as a,
they
to
must
show
be
you.
Awfully hot.
I only bought this for curiosity's sake. I never once wore it over in the country. Quite a few Western women do wear one just for the fact that then they don't have to change clothes if they're wearing a dress at home, a short dress, and have to go into town. They throw on an abaya. I always felt that seemed a little bit insensitive or something to be wearing this abaya. They would tie it up in a big knot in the front and I don't know, I just could never do it myself. And somehow, for one thing, it is so beastly hot, you can't even breathe in it.
Yep.
But there's a whole study on veils and the different countries, the different types of veils. When we visited the country of Qatar, which is just a tiny country connected to Saudi Arabia, there the women wore these sort of cardboard masks almost that came out to a point. It looked like a beak of a bird. And the veil that I brought here is a Bedouin veil, the Bedouin being the more tribal people that live in the desert. And they actually have holes for their eyes. But in Dahran, since it's falling apart, when we went shopping, all the women wore only the black gauze covering their entire face, so you couldn't see their...
Yeah, that's the way she was.
Right. You couldn't see their eyes at all. When we went to the market towns and the Bedouin towns, then the women would wear this type. See if I can even get it on. Like that. And then covered with the gauze over their head, so you're sure that no hair shows at all.
Mm-hmm.
Like that. And then the abaya goes on. I've done this for a while. Yeah, see if I can still over the top like that.
It was so obvious,
the only thing
though,
that shows
You know, she was the only one with all these hundreds of people.
Right.
And so, I mean, it stuck out like a sore thumb, and everybody felt so sorry for her.
Oh, these are beastly hot, really hot. Sometimes you would see women who were so extreme that they even wore black gloves on their hands and black stockings on their legs, so you were sure that, you know, you would not see any flesh
at all. What is the material?
This is nylon, very hot. Yeah. But it was always fun when we'd go to market towns. You could go to a buy a shops. Oh. It was like going, you know, to a fashion store here, except it's all black abayas. It always seemed kind of funny, racks and racks of abayas. But you could buy silk.
Spell that word for me.
A-B-I-Y-A-H. But some of them were made of silk and had black sort of lace trim. They're really quite beautiful. And they could be very expensive. I remember seeing one that was would have been about $150. Mm-hmm. And so, as much as I thought it'd be nice to have it just for a token, I went and bought the cheap one, where, you know, bartered for it in the marketplace for about $8 or something.
Earlier you said that that everyone, all women, had to wear long sleeves and long skirts when they went shopping. What would have happened to someone if they didn't follow that rule?
Many people didn't. In fact, I must admit that I did go to town a couple times with sort of sleeves to here and calf-length dress. Oddly enough, the only person that ever stopped me was a Western man who stopped me and said, "How long have you lived in this country?" And I said, 4 years. He said, "Well, you should know better than that." I couldn't work. And that was their job, was to watch for anybody dressed indecently. One thing they really looked for in women were women who wore makeup. I don't tend to wear makeup, so maybe that's why I didn't stand out so much. They are very, very sort of prejudiced against any Asian women, because Asian women in that country are usually brought in as prostitutes. And so I had one friend who was Chinese, Hawaiian, Chinese by birth, but raised in Hawaii. And she was stopped once and just given a really horrible time. And she was wearing like a pantsuit, pants with a long tunic. And they insisted that her pants were too tight, which was ridiculous. They weren't tight at all. They were quite baggy. But they gave her husband a written notice. It's always the husband who's given the notice that his wife is not in line. And had a warning, and I think he was supposed to be fined. Well, he took it to the university president or something, and I don't know, some politics went on there where the fine was dropped. But usually women were stopped only when they were with their husband, and then he was the one that was given the warning, because I don't think it would be proper for the mutawa to talk to the woman herself. And maybe that's another thing, I often just went on my own shopping. But these men, and I've been reading about them quite a bit since the war, the mutawa now have come out very strong again, because with all the Westerners, with all the soldiers, with the women driving jeeps and wearing fatigues and stuff, a lot of the Saudis, I think, have seen this and sort of loosened up a bit in their ways. And I read a long article in the Wall Street Journal, I think, about the mutawa now coming down very strong and imposing a lot more of these rules. The mutawa also not only watched for indecent dress, but they always went around at prayer time. Prayer time happens 5 times a day, and it varies depending on the length of the day, because it's all in relation to the sun. But they're usually 2 or 3 prayer times in the evening hours, which is always when we would go shopping. And so as soon as it was prayer time, everything just shuts down immediately. So you have to wait outside for 20 minutes or 30 minutes, whatever it is, before you can do your shopping. So the mutawa always often would patrol the streets and make sure that the shops were closed and no business was going on. There were a lot of restaurants. It was always so tricky to go out to eat because of prayer time. You had to time it just right before prayer time. But there were quite a few restaurants where they would let you in, serve you, and then during prayer time shut all the doors and turn off the lights. But they let you stay there to eat. But they were always real worried about being caught. So then if you wanted to leave during prayer time, you always had to go out a back way and sort of sneak to your car, because they were real nervous about you being left there for a time. So the mutawa would go up and down in cars and have loudspeakers and call out that it's prayer time, and shut down. And the stores, that was a real interesting thing to get used to. And by the end, we always got where we looked at our little prayer time chart before we went into town to try to time it just right. But I did read, I meant to bring that article too, and I forgot to, about the real surge now. The Mutawa have no real power in the country, but politically, when King Saud took over the country and unified the country and turned it into Saudi Arabia, he could only do that by really placating the ultra-religious groups and the fundamentalist groups, because they were so strong at that time that he made a lot of concessions to them to get their support and to unify the country. And so the Mutawa are probably the most extreme of that group. And though the Al Saud family in many ways wants to westernize the country, would like to open things up more, they have to walk in very...
What is the main religious background of that country?
Islam is the religion. And
the Sunnis?
Just what is that? I mean, what is there?
I'll just say briefly, and my husband John is going to give kind of a more broad overview of that this evening, I think at 5:45, if you want to hear more in detail. But Islam was started by the Prophet Muhammad around the year 600, or he was born around the year 600. And the Quran, which is their Bible,
uh-huh.
has many similarities to our Old Testament. Many of the same Jewish and Christian roots are there. They believe that Abraham was born in Mecca, which is their holiest of holy places now. So they have many roots to Abraham, to Isaac, many of the Old Testament roots. And they believe in Jesus as having been a prophet, but not as having been the Son of God. But they in the Quran is written also about Jesus, but they have very definite limitations.
Different set.
Right. To be a Muslim, you only have to say one thing. You have to say that there is no God but God, which they call Allah. There is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet. And if you believe those two things, then you are a practicing Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
Then you also have certain rituals that you have to do, and one of these is to pray five times a day, and not just a short prayer, but it's a real ritual. And another is to hopefully sometime in your lifetime make a pilgrimage back to Mecca. You're supposed to do that at least once in your life, and there are certain rules that you need to follow to be a Muslim, but the main thing is that there is one God. Right.
Are women included in that prayer time?
Yes, although women are supposed to pray, but it was always so obvious at prayer time, you would see men, huge groups of men kneeling down and doing the whole rites of prayer. I never saw a woman do that. I think they're supposed to do it in the private of their own home, but they are supposed to pray.
So nobody knows whether they're doing it or not.
Right, exactly. Maybe they can get by with it.
There's an interesting book called The Woman of Egypt. Have you read that? By Jihan Sadat. And that's the widow of Anwar.
I'm familiar with it, right.
And she writes, it's an autobiographical sketch or book of her life, and she's now teaching at Georgetown University, or at the time when I read it she was.
Mm-hmm.
But Egypt is not Saudi, but still the rules are there, and how she overcame these rules is a remarkable story. She's a remarkable woman.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And it's A Woman of Egypt by Sadat.
Yeah.
There's also a movie that has just come out this past year called Not Without My Daughter. And that's another book. I don't know.
I've heard of that, but I'm not familiar with it.
I felt like it was extremely prejudiced towards the Arab culture. I mean, I didn't feel
like... That's very likely.
You know.
There are a couple books. There's one just called Saudis that is written by a woman. Oh boy, these names are escaping me today. She's a woman who managed to get a job in a government office in Saudi Arabia, wrote articles for the Christian Science Monitor, and smuggled them out of the country under a man's name, Michael Collins, I think. And And that's a really informative book. I think one thing that I have really discovered in living there is that you hear of the ways of the Saudi world, but people tend to overgeneralize. And, you know, the whole thing about if you steal something, you'll get your hand cut off. Well, that's true, but it really hardly ever happens anymore. And I found out in this Saudi book, I felt like she did too much of that kind of thing, of talking like, you know, it's this way and it's this way everywhere. And we heard many stories like that when we first moved there, and I really thought, what am I doing in this country? Because it sounded so horrible. And really there are isolated incidents that happen, but generally speaking, things aren't always as strict and rigid as those books maintain.
Mm-hmm. This particular book was talking about how women are often terribly abused by their husbands. Did you see any of that? Or?
Well, I didn't, but then I guess I wouldn't either. I wouldn't have.
That was because she was going against what he had, and she wanted to have her child to, I mean, she had just gone there to visit.
Right, but
also, she was thrown into it and told she had to do this.
I know that it is strictly forbidden in the Quran for a husband to abuse his wife, and a wife has every right to seek a divorce if that is happening. So there again, it was when something was written as a right for a woman that she didn't used to have, and it was a way out of a situation like that.
She could get out, but she couldn't take her daughter with us.
I don't have...
This happens in other countries, too. This happens in South America. Yeah. You can't take the children out of the country without the husband's permission in some countries.
Yeah. You really start to realize just the right of being able to leave your country is means so much. And for us living there, we could never leave the country without having an exit visa. And you don't just get an exit visa. It's a procedure to get it, and it's money to pay for it. The university always held on to our passports, which we never liked either, because they had a very sloppy filing system, and more than one passport was lost. And during our last year there, when the Iran-Iraq war was really heating up, and it was the year that the American plane shot down the Iranian plane, I believe. And so there was a lot of tension in the area. There was a lot of talk of evacuation and the procedure we would take. But everybody said, you know, it's easy to talk about, but how would we logistically do it? We don't have a passport. We don't have an exit visa. It's going to be a lot more difficult than we expected. So we have friends in Seattle right now who left last August on an evacuation flight when the war was heating up, when Iraq invaded Kuwait, and apparently they did lessen a lot of the restrictions to get them out of there, back to this country.
Yeah. I'd like to add that my granddaughter's husband's name was Muhammad, too.
Oh, yeah, that's and the most common name.
Very, very proud of him. Uh-huh. He was very proud of the name, and some Americans in the school wanted to call him Mo, or you know, but he didn't want any part of that.
It's very, very common for the first son to be named Mohammed, and you're right, there are more Mohammeds than you can.
But he was the last one.
Oh, really?
Yes,
oh,
he was the last one.
That's interesting.
And there were five in the family, and they were all, like you say, educated in America.
Mm-hmm. It used to be that the men were almost always sent to the West to get their education.
Yes.
Then they started realizing that the men were being corrupted in many ways and finding Western women. Now the policy is to teach them in their own country. Thus, this University of Petroleum and Minerals, where my husband taught, everything there is taught in English, which is a most unusual thing to think of a college in your country being taught in another language, but it's all technology, and they have a very intensive English language program, which my husband taught in.
They're very intense, very well educated. We got into these games, you know, that you play where you answer questions. He knew more about America, American geography, American history, than my granddaughters did. He was just very well educated, and he's reading all the time. I just admired him.
Sure.
His ambition.
It is amazing. Yeah, fortunately for most Saudi people, money is no object, and when it comes to getting an education abroad, money is not the factor, it's usually getting permission.
His father was a chieftain. He had land in Kuwait, in Arabia, and in Syria, and he overlooked it. To me, it was like an Indian chieftain, where he had many people under him. So he was very wealthy.
Yeah. I have a question going back to restrictions on women. You talked about going to market by yourself, and a book I read, Beyond the Veil, was written, I think it was written by a doctor named Seymour Gray, and he had been there, I think, in the mid-70s, so perhaps things have loosened up some, but I know one of the things he said in that book was women, even Western women, needed always to be accompanied by a man or travel with at least two or three other women so that they were not suspect of being prostitutes sort of out on their own, because a lone woman was automatically assumed to be a prostitute.
If you traveled at all, that would definitely be the case. Uh-huh. Just to go into the town where we lived, about 5 miles from town, they had a shopping bus that went twice a week, which was a school bus that they took the women in. And so we would sometimes go in groups. You could also ride the public bus, but the women sit at the back of the bus in a walled-off area. I did that a couple times. It was a real interesting experience, but it is about the last two or three rows are walled off, and you get in at the back and can sit there. But to travel at all, you are supposed to have the written permission of your husband, and it's really frowned upon to do that at all. I have one friend who, on a whim, I can't believe she did this, decided she was going to take the train from Dhahran on the coast where we live to Riyadh, which is the capital and which is probably the strictest of all the areas in the country as far as women. She decided she was going to do this. They were about to leave for good, and she was going to take her children and go on this train trip to Riyadh. Just did it. Well, she got to Riyadh, and they wouldn't let her out of the train station. She had no permission to be there with her husband. Here was this, you know, woman with her children. They took her down to the police station. They wouldn't let her go to a hotel. And she had to sit in the police station with her four little children until 2 o'clock in the morning before they finally allowed her to go to a hotel just to sleep. And then they wanted her out of there in the morning. So she said, she had lived there for years. I can't believe she'd done it. But she said it was quite an experience. And she was quite upset about it, actually. But you're right, as far as any kind of travel like that, I don't think I ever would have done on my own.
Can families travel within the country? Sure. So you need an exit visa to leave the country, but within the country, are you free to come and go wherever you
want? We were, and we didn't do a lot within Saudi Arabia ourselves. We should have done more. The western side of the country is supposedly beautiful, mountainous, around Taif is... Mm-hmm. Quite a few people went on camping trips there. We always had babies when we were over there, so it was always so hard to travel. But we did go on camping trips out into the desert, which was really quite beautiful to go out in the sandy desert and just camp out and watch for the scorpions and things like that. But it was really, really quite fun. As just a little bit of advertising, I'm going to say that tomorrow evening at 5:45, John and I are going to do something that's called the Bafa Bafa game, and it's a sort of simulation game of what it's like to be exposed to a new culture where you don't know what's going on and you don't know what the rules are, and it's really a lot of fun, and it shows a lot of insight into this kind of thing. But I think it's always true that you can read and read and talk to people, but when you're there's lots of little things that come up that you never quite expect. On the topic of the differences in the countries, somebody mentioned Egypt. We visited Turkey for one summer, and which is also a Muslim country, but absolutely entirely different from Saudi Arabia. And having come from Saudi Arabia, I just couldn't get over it. I mean, here were, you know, women wearing short skirts and walking hand in hand with their husbands, and there was a huge amusement park, and the families were there, and laughing and having a great time, and music playing. That was one thing you never hear in Saudi Arabia is music. And I just couldn't get over it. But we met four American women who were living there. They were actually though it took them days before they admitted this to us, they were actually there doing missionary work, but they were very much undercover about it. They didn't want anybody to know. And I was going on and on one day to one woman about, I just couldn't get over this country, it's so free and easy. And she said, all I can say is I can tell you've come from Saudi Arabia. Because having lived there as a woman, she found many of the same restrictions that the other countries impose. They're a lot more subtle. But we did notice, we went out to a restaurant one day with this one woman, knew some Turkish, and she volunteered to take us around Istanbul. Went to a restaurant, and we kind of sat back and let her do the ordering, since she spoke Turkish. And she could not get a waiter to come over, and she kept calling them over and calling them over, and we didn't think much about it. We just thought, well, it's a busy place. Well, this went on and on. I think it was close to an hour. Finally, John waved to a fellow. He said, could we get some help here? And just like that, we had service, and you know, they were there, and they took our order, and they fed us, and it became very apparent that because she was the woman that was trying to get the service, nobody was going to pay much attention to her. So I think in the Muslim countries in general, you will find those restrictions, so probably not nearly as overt as in Saudi Arabia. I would love to be there now and see what it's like since the war has happened. I was just aghast watching news clips of Dhahran. There was our home, and jeeps all over, and women running around with guns over their shoulders, and the thing that just blew my mind was the night they had Bob Hope had a show for the soldiers, and I just thought, I've just got to watch this, and it was...
He had it on a ship, though, didn't he?
No, it was on it was out in the desert, and you could just see these soldiers as far as you could see, and he stood up there and just told one beer and sex joke after another, and everybody was just, you know, laughing, and I just thought, wow, I can't believe this is the same country that they're sitting in. They definitely let down their guard to let the Americans in and do what they did at the time.
So. Are the restrictions, such as the wall and the bus and the all that, is there some sense of ritual impurity? I mean, what's behind that? I spent 2 years in New Guinea. There are all kinds of stuff there still about, you know, if men and women eat together, things will happen.
Exactly.
Is that behind it?
I think so. I think originally and basically, I think, is the idea to protect the woman. Mm-hmm. You know, if she should tempt a man, then who knows what could happen.
So there's all kinds of sexual innuendo.
Exactly. And, I remember a friend of mine just blowing up at our own recreation center in the university. They made a rule that any girl, once the girls reached 8 years of age, they couldn't wear shorts anymore. And this friend of mine just blew up about that. She said, you know, what are you saying? That my daughter's going to be tempting these men and has to be covered? But ultimately, and I think a lot of Saudi women would say, they feel protected being shrouded and being covered, especially when that's what they're raised with. But yeah, there's a lot of, it's mostly sexual.
Well, it's just never perceived as man's problem, though.
Exactly. I know.
Well, one of the things to go along with that, and that is, if you say that the Quran was written for the protection and the rights of women, it seems to me that a lot of women in their early 60s and 70s, when they were talking about feminist things, had a lot of, I mean, and still do, a lot of trouble with St. Paul. And then biblical scholars went back and said, but this was really quite freeing, and you have to understand. Is anybody doing, I mean, there seems to me that they get stuck in the past someplace, or is there anybody that has a liberal word about now reinterpreting this in the light of modern?
I think gradually it's happening. I'm sure there are many people in Saudi Arabia who hope that happens quite soon. Mm-hmm. And apparently there were a lot during the war that felt like, now we're we're all being exposed. You know, the Westerners are here. Maybe this will really change things.
You know, earlier this summer we had someone here was doing some work on
comparative religions. And what he talked about Islam, one thing that he stressed, which I think is so different than Christianity, is that the religion and the culture are inseparable in
Islam.
It's not like us looking at the Bible and saying, oh, well, St. Paul wrote that about those people back there in Corinth or whatever, but that's not our culture and we're not part of that world. But in Islam, the culture and the religion are the same. So what's in the Quran is not just something that applies to way back when with Muhammad. That it's very essential to their sense of identity.
Right.
And so I don't see the same potential for criticism and change as we may see.
Well, you probably all heard about the women in Riyadh last fall, was it, that took off and started driving cars. Mm-hmm. About 50 women decided to heck with this and then jumped in their cars. Of course, nobody's heard really what's happened to them since then, but I did read a couple weeks ago that there are reports that they're still in prison and their husbands are in prison. So although there, I'm sure there's quite a strong faction that says, you know, let's get with the modern times.
And that would maybe be an option if they were willing to move to another country.
Right.
But to remain in their own country.
In their own country, yeah.
When you're talking about these people over there, who apparently are all in the affluent class.
Pretty much.
Do you find a group of people over there who are poverty?
Almost, no, without exception. Only one time in our 5 years there did we go to a market town where there's a very rural town with a camel market, and I saw one beggar woman. She looked just very, very poor. But they have ways of going to the emir, like the leaders of your province, or even to the king with requests for money, for land, for all different things, and generally they're met. They can do that because not only do they now have a lot of wealth, but they have a very, very small population for the amount of land that they have. And so the wealth is not an issue, though it was getting to be somewhat of one. The year we left, the stories we heard from people who had been there 8 years before, you know, the money was just, you know, they were given bonuses and raises all the time, and the new king came in, and everyone was given a huge bonus because of that. And when we left, they were starting to have taxes on things, and that was the first time that any taxes were coming up, and you could hear a lot of dissent about that, and I wasn't sure. Suddenly there was you had to get a license for your car and pay for that, and different permits you had to pay taxes for. John and I feel quite strongly that as long as the money is there, the Saud family will continue to reign. But, you know, they're on pretty shaky ground, really. And they're, as long as they can placate all the people and keep them happy, I think they will continue to rule. But if that should, that situation should change, which I think it probably will inevitably, then who knows what could happen. Just who knows?
Getting back to religion, I worked with Middle Eastern students for about 3 years in Nebraska. And one told me that, and I don't know if it's in the Quran or not, but to question is a sin, so that kind of represses some of any trend toward looking at the scripture critically or in a modern bit. And I went over there for one of these quick tourist trips, but since I've met two students, I went to one home in Cairo and one in Amman, Jordan, and I came back depressed for about a year because there seemed so little hope of progress. One talked in Egypt, talked about Sadat, and so he was so much more advanced, you might say, in some ways. But he rewarded his village with a new well and got jobs for all the men in the village. And this seemed to be the pattern, that you wait for your tribe, your uncle, to get in power and then reward you. And if you try to reach out for a compromise or consensus, you're in danger of getting your throat cut, because that's being a traitor to your own little tight group. It's not a case, it's either if you're not of my group, you're the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
And
anything bad happens, it's the will of Allah. The building fell down because of the rotten cement. Well, it's the will of Allah. And it was very discouraging to me.
John found it very, very difficult in teaching. He always felt like these people can't think their own thoughts, that, you know, everything has been told, this is the way it is, this is the way it is. The restrictions on his teaching were just, you know, almost impossible. They could talk about nothing but technology, basically. When you're teaching English, you're not allowed to speak about women, you're not allowed to speak about things outside of the country. One day, John somehow mentioned Israel and created quite an uproar. He said right away, all the people, the students in his class, claimed that Israel was the United States, was the 51st state of the United States. And it was obvious that it was something that they had all learned because they all came out with it simultaneously. So you're right, they are so restricted in their ways of thinking and what they believe, that's a real hard thing to sort of deal with. And it all comes out in our politics and the policies of trying to work with the countries and creating peace or, you know, creating better human rights.
Sometimes we take too much.
The statistics seem to show these days that Islam is the biggest growing, fastest growing religion around. What's the big attraction?
I think it's a simple religion. I don't think it's money because, you know, there are far more Muslims in Indonesia than there are in the Middle East. We tend to think of Islam in the Middle East as being hand in hand, but actually there are many more Muslims in Indonesia. They're not wealthy by any means. They're quite poor. I think it's quite a simple religion as far as here's the rules, you follow the rules, and you're okay. And I think that's real comforting to some people, that they figure that I've done my prayers, I've done my pilgrimage, and in that way, I think it's quite easy. I don't know, I feel like in Christianity, there's just so many loose ends, and people are always searching and wondering, and am I doing this the right way? And maybe to have it dictated to you is an easier way to live. That's the only thing I could come up with because I don't see at all where it's an enlightening type of life.
Did you have Christian services?
Never.
Ever.
Well, with one exception, any kind of religious practice is strictly forbidden in the country, with the exception of Aramco, which is the big oil company there in compound. To go to Aramco is just like going to a town in Southern California. It looks the very same, except that the golf course is all sand instead of grass. And they did allow church services in the gymnasium of their school there. They have their own school, they have their own stores. And the pastor there is called a teaching assistant. But they have regular church services. We went to a couple of them. Not only did we feel quite uncomfortable with the church services, they were, just very different than what we were used to. But for us to get into Aramco was always a real trial. And usually you had to lie and you had to say you were going to visit somebody or something. We always felt a little funny lying to get in and then going to church, having our daughter sit in the back.